supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Back in 2000, journalist Barbara Ehrenreich turned her experiment of living on minimum wage into the book entitled Nickel and Dimed, detailing all the hidden costs of being poor in America. Being broke, she said, was a double burden. For example, having no money means you can't buy food in bulk, so you pay more per item. It's hard to pull together a down payment, so you end up in higher-cost housing that you can pay for piecemeal. Now, 20 years on, little has changed about those hidden costs. Here to talk more with me about that is Jean Friedman-Radofsky. She heads the Broken Philly Reporting Project, a collaboration between WHYY and 18 other news organizations to explain what it's like to be poor in the city. Jean, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Jean, today Broken Philly is rolling out its series entitled The High Cost of Being Broke. Where'd the idea come from?
So I'd say the seed for the idea came from a man named Reuben Jones, who is the executive director of Frontline Dads, and he's a formerly incarcerated person I got to know when doing the Reentry Project last year, a similar collaboration of news organizations. We're looking at issues of prisoner reentry. And when we were putting together the Broken Philly Project, I got together with Reuben and kind of said, what should we be reporting on? You know, give me some ideas. What should we be thinking about? How can we do this maybe better than we've done in the past? And he said, you know what I want you to do? He said, I want you to figure out the cost of gas in neighborhoods all around the city. He said, because I'm convinced that in my neighborhood, where there's a high rate of people experiencing poverty, it costs more than if I drive to a place that has people who are more economically well off. Because they know that, you know, people aren't going to drive those few extra miles to go buy something, to go buy gas that costs less. And so it costs more in my neighborhood. And he said, so I want you to report on that, and I want you to do a map and figure out whether that's, you know, true, and, you know, prove it, essentially. So that was the kind of seed for it. And then in conversations actually with folks here at WHYY and a couple other news organizations involved in this collaboration, it was Gene Sun, the news director here at WHYY, that said, why don't we do a reporting project about this topic sort of more broadly, the high cost of being broke, right? What is more expensive when you actually have less money? What we did for the launch of this series was look at 8 other topics. 5 different media organizations doing 8 stories on the high cost of diapers, oral health, transportation, overdraft fees, alternative financial services, cell phones, and then food affordability in a couple different ways.
And mentioning transportation, WHYY's Aaron Mozell put together that story. Mm-hmm. What were some of the findings?
Right. So in Aaron's reporting, what he found is Jacqueline Chaplin, which is one of the main people in his reporting, had a job as a classroom aide for the school district, earning $139 every 2 weeks. And she spent about $60 on transportation. And that leaves no margin at all for any unexpected costs to come up.
Something would happen in life where you might need a couple of dollars from your car fare to make up for whatever you had to use it for, maybe to eat. You know, you had to make a decision. How am I going to get the money to replace the money that I'm spending for my car fare? And most of the time you would end up borrowing the money, which is not good, because then when you do get the money, you got to pay that back and you still got to get to work.
Chapman lost that job, and what she's done now is basically hoard a bunch of tokens and then walk as much as she can. And then there's another woman named Ryan Franks, who has a full-time job but has a hard time getting around for much of the same reasons. She works as a housing counselor, and she can afford to buy weekly transpasses, but she doesn't have enough money at any one time to actually buy a monthly pass, which would save her $5 monthly, $60 over the course of a year.
For a person who you would think could afford it, there are days where I can't. I can't afford my transpass, or if I buy my transpass, I won't be able to buy lunch for the week. That has happened, where I have to take, you know, and a lot of people say, well, just take a bag lunch. But if you're forgetful like myself and you leave it on the counter, you know, you don't have lunch.
Now, another example where there's a national program in place that also benefits Philadelphia pertains to the high cost of diapers. And again, it was WHYY's Taylor Allen who looked into that problem.
Yeah. She found that, people can spend anywhere, I think, between $120 and over $200 a month on diapers, which is, an incredible amount of money. And of course, anyone who is a parent knows that if you buy diapers in bulk, they are much, much cheaper than if you buy them in small packages at CVS or at corner stores. And so there is a program that helps people who have been experiencing homelessness in various different ways. But one of the ways is actually they give subsidized diapers, which, can be a huge relief for young parents.
How do you see the series evolving from here?
So I think we want this to be an ongoing series. We consider this sort of the launch, and we want it to go on through the rest of the year and into next year. And so what we'd love to do is get ideas from the public about what we should be reporting on next. What are your most surprising everyday expenses? What do you think has a really high cost if you are someone who is experiencing economic hardship? And so we have a text line, which is 215-774-3212. I'll say it one more time. 215-774-3212. Text us in your ideas for the stories that we should be doing, and we will try to make those happen.
Jean, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Jean Freeman-Rudofsky is editor of Broken Philly, and you can learn more at brokeinphilly.org. Seventy-3 years ago today, America dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan. It was the first time a nuclear weapon had been used in war. Later that day, a 21-year-old pilot from Lancaster County just happened to fly over the flattened city, and he's never forgotten what he saw when he looked down. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
One of the first things you'll notice about Charlie Rettig is his laugh. It's deep, hearty, and bursts out a lot when he talks about his time as a bomber pilot in World War II. He laughs when he describes his interactions with native people in the Gilbert Islands, or the time he took a random GI named Joe for a plane ride in Hawaii.
I knew the name, but I didn't connect the two till he said, "My name's Joe DiMaggio." I thought, I wonder if this is the ball player,
When Rettig starts talking about August 6, 1945, it sounds like another one of his fantastical war adventures.
We left for Tokyo, and we flew close to the Emperor's Castle to take a picture.
On the way back from that pit stop over the castle, Rettig and his crew spotted a mushroom-shaped cloud over Hiroshima.
I can still almost see it clearly.
Here, the war story stops, and something more dreadful emerges.
My top turret gunner, who can see everything, he gets me on the air. He said, "Are we lost?" I said, "No, what do you mean, are we lost?" Well, he said, "Look down there." I put the nose down, and it's unbelievable.
What had been a bustling city earlier that day was gone.
There was nothing. Nothing. No movement. What happened to all these people? And buses and trucks and cars and everything, they're gone. And why is only a couple walls standing where this was a major city? I thought of earthquake. I thought, no, that can't do it. We had no idea what it was.
U.S. President Harry Truman soon told the world exactly what it was.
It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
Rettig was born in 1924 in the tiny town of Five Pointville in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. A local doctor tried to ride a sleigh through the snow to deliver him, but couldn't make it in time. Now, after 69 combat missions, he'd seen the most devastating technology ever unleashed in battle.
I mean, I couldn't imagine. I thought maybe I was lost, to be honest about it,
Rettig would lose his hair temporarily due to radiation exposure. And then the war ended. He carried on with his life, became an electrical engineer, and helped make televisions for RCA. He still lives on a quiet country road with his wife, Carmen. Few people alive today, and even fewer American service members, have seen what the 94-year-old saw on August 6, 1945. And so one wonders, naturally, what Rettig thinks about the use of that bomb in that war. And like so many Americans, he's torn.
It was probably a good thing. It did shorten, though. I think for both sides, they would have lost a lot of men, too, you know. I don't know if it was right or wrong, but I think it was a good idea, you know.
Rettig is more firm when it comes to the topic of war generally. He hates it.
The people that win, what did they win? You know? I mean, even the winners lost so much.
Rettig has an idea for future generations, an alternative to war.
I think there ought to be a better way. I think the leaders ought to put on boxing gloves and go in the ring, and what best man wins.
When he tells people his idea, they think the old man is kidding. But he's not.
I still think the leaders ought to fight it out.
And just like that, from the darkest of places, Charlie Rettig's laugh resurfaces, still booming, 7 decades after the biggest blast in human history. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
3 years ago, Delaware received a $1.2 million federal grant to check 900 untested rape kits for DNA evidence. The money was part of a national effort to test upwards of 100,000 kits and solve languishing sexual assault cases. Now, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports, that effort is bearing fruit.
The evidence kits have been sitting on shelves in hospitals and police departments, in some cases for nearly 3 decades. But now, almost all have been analyzed at a Virginia lab. And last week, the first breakthrough came when Wilmington police used evidence from a kit to make an arrest in a 2014 rape. 39-year-old Keeley Mayfield was already facing charges in a 2017 rape, and he'd been a suspect in a 2010 case that wasn't part of the initiative. Former police officer Michael Kelly is coordinating the effort for the Delaware Criminal Justice Council.
Definitely, it's a good feeling to have a case that's come to be where you see the end result. You see that there was indictments from the case, that the Attorney General's Office and law enforcement, the investigators, were able to put this together. And he's looking at 3 separate cases, and he can be held accountable for his actions.
State Senator Nicole Poor, a Bear Area Democrat who helped spearhead the effort to get the federal funds, became emotional upon hearing about its initial success.
It's an amazing feeling, but definitely overwhelming, simply because while we're ecstatic that there's an arrest, there's still a victim that has to relive that whole process.
Poor says the endeavor is raising awareness, and that can empower rape victims.
I just think that there's room for opportunity to make sure that those folks that are taking advantage of others, they don't have a lifetime of doing this over and over again.
Kelly and Poor say they're hoping when the grant expires next year, the state will get more funding to continue the effort. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Even though Luis Angel Sandoval, age 24, earned legal status under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program 3 years ago after graduating high school, that does not erase the uncertainty he's felt since age 6 when he arrived in the United States. After achieving his dream of becoming a barber, he now works in South Philadelphia. But the temporary and unresolved nature of U.S. immigration policy makes it impossible for Sandoval to get a visa or travel, or even plan beyond 2 years. Roy Aguilar of NPR's Next Generation Radio Project produced this story in which Luis Sandoval talks about living a life of uncertainty.
Undocumented is on a middle finger, and on my index finger it says unafraid, and then on my ring finger on my right hand, you know, they're all on the same right hand, you know, 3 back-to-back, it says relentless.
So my name's Luis Angel Sandoval, Luis Angel Sandoval. I was born in Juarez. I crossed when I was 6 in 1999. We're here in the backyard of my parents' home. We have a basketball court here. I have a younger sister. I have 2 younger sisters, one that crossed the border with me and then the other one that was born here. I will go to school
And I would just be miserable and sometimes would just break down because I did not know English. I didn't know any way to communicate with kids around me and around my age and around speaking different languages. And that was very intimidating. And I would break down and just cry. And it didn't hit me until 2012 when I graduated, when I was about to graduate. And that's when I realized, okay, I'm illegal. I'm undocumented. I can't continue on with life as everyone else is. I kind of have to find loopholes and you know, jump over barriers and kind of, you know, move differently than everyone else is living. When I got out of high school, I went around warehouses knocking on doors. Hey, you know, I'm 18. I'm willing to work. I speak both languages, but I don't have Social Security. You know what I mean? This is my barber room, and this is where I lay my head at. When I first started cutting hair, it was all my equipment. Literally, all my equipment was here. You know, I was like, hey, mom, got a barber chair. Do you mind if I set up over there? Yeah, I have the Sanex strips mounted on the wall. The barber pole. Yeah, I got the barber pole mounted on the wall. It lights up, but it doesn't rotate. See, barbering was something that helped get me a little bit of cash during high school. Barbering helped me stay grounded. It helped me to always like get my artistic juices flowing. And it always helped me to kind of express myself. It helped me to stay sociable. It helped me to stay, you know, in track with what everyone's doing because everyone comes to see me. What's up, gang? How y'all doing? So you want to shape up the size a little bit?
Shape this up, cut this down. Over here, clean up the back right here.
My ultimate dream would really be to have my own business. You know what I mean? I want to open up my barber shop with a license, my barber's managers, and it's sad and it's depressing living with the fear of deportation. It's sad to think about the fact that I have to consciously live with the thought that all that I have here can be taken at any second, and then I would kind of have to go through the process of crossing the border again.
Luis Sandoval telling his story for NPR's Next Generation Radio Project. Just because warm summer nights continue to provide a great opportunity for skygazing, let's continue the conversation with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Now, Derek, we've been focusing on planets for the past couple of weeks, but first, let's prepare for a shower.
And no soap is needed for this, unless it's some sort of stellar shower soap. This is the Perseid meteor shower we speak of. It's the annual meteor shower that shows up every year right around August the 12th.
And what might one see on August the 12th?
Hopefully, under clear, dark skies, you'll be standing where you'll be able to see these bright streaks of light zipping across the sky. We call them falling stars or shooting stars, of course, knowing that stars don't fall and stars don't shoot. But these colloquial names, of course, apply to what the appearance is in the sky as you see this. They look like stars that are dropping from the sky that zip across within seconds and disappear. And they can be seen all over the sky. The rate, of course, is somewhere between 60 and 100 per hour. So it's a very prominent shower.
Is it the most prominent of the showers throughout the year?
Well, as it turns out, it's not. It used to be. The Perseid used to be the primary shower of the year. But that's been replaced now by the Geminid meteor shower, which happens in mid-December. That shower you can see up to 110 to 120 per hour, given the right sky conditions. Nonetheless, you'll see these pieces of rock falling into the Earth's atmosphere. They left over from the comet Swift-Tuttle. Swift-Tuttle was most recently in this portion of the solar system in 1992. It has a period of about 133 years, so it'll be back again in 2126, so don't hold your breath for that one, but at least you can see some of the material that melted out of the nucleus of comet Swift-Tuttle and is now strewn across along an orbital path that the Earth passes through every year at the same time.
Hey, what's this about a probe making its way to the sun? How does it keep from burning right up?
The probe we're speaking of is the Parker Solar Probe, which is an effort by NASA and a group of researchers to try to get a better handle on some vagaries about the sun, the primary one of which is the sun's outer corona, its outer atmosphere, is so much hotter than the rest of the sun. The surface of the sun checks in at about 10,000 to 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you move down into the sun, of course, the temperature goes up till we get down near the core where the temperature is nearly 20 million degrees. As we move up off the surface of the sun into the outer, quote-unquote, atmosphere of the sun, we come into this very, very tenuous region called the corona of the sun. And the corona is very, very thin, but as it turns out, the corona is millions of degrees in temperature, and scientists do not understand why that is. Our corona is very, very difficult for us to see. We only knew of the corona studying solar eclipses when the moon, blocking enough light from the sun, would allow the very, very thin and tenuous corona to show up under a darkened sky. Now we use instruments that have what's called a coronagraph that blocks out the light from the disk of the sun itself so that we can then study the corona. And, of course, getting close enough to it will also help us to understand the nature of the corona itself so that we can try to figure out what the mechanism is that allows this temperature range to exist.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.